This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So this is Koki and I's last Sunday for a while. Yeah, have been gratefully been here at Jikoji for all summer. And now going to a practice event to Colorado this week, and then respond to a request in Marin, and hopefully return back to Jikoji in some way or another sooner or later. But it has been a great joy, and particularly I loved all the Dharma conversations we have so far. And so today I would like to invite us into another Dharma conversation, and this time around the topic of the unity of wisdom and compassion. And I kind of want to bring it up, particularly I heard the request or the observation that Zen doesn't talk much about compassion. So I want to just bring it up and maybe underline where it is in our tradition and how important it is to have in pretty conscious in our and active in our practice. Particularly, I was reminded yesterday in a quote that I came across where it was underlined again that without wisdom and compassion, there's just no way we advance on our path. And here in this quote, and here in this Dhamma talk, emptiness and wisdom are considered the ultimate mind awakening, bodhicitta, and compassion is the relative bodhicitta. What does that mean? As we know, like in many other traditions, compassion is very much emphasized, loving kindness is very much emphasized, you know, love thy neighbor as yourself, you know, that's kind of like a golden rule in the Abrahamic traditions, and many other traditions very much emphasize, you know, kindness as being part of the path to maturation, spiritual maturation. However, we also know, and many of us probably have experienced that, you know, if you find yourself 24/7 in a soup kitchen and serving the needy, it's just not going to end. There's just no end to, you know, pain in this world. There's just no end to all the suffering that we encounter. And that's where Buddhism is saying there is an end to it. And that end is when you realize wisdom, meaning emptiness. If we, in our meditations, in our practice, in our contemplation, come to an understanding of emptiness, then that is an end of suffering. Because once you know the unity, the non-dual nature of our life, then the suffering will cease, suffering will come to an end. And then you also not only have your own suffering be ended, you also will become very, very skillful with other people's suffering, because ultimately all our suffering is the same suffering. And that's where compassion is also super, super important, because compassion is our relationship with suffering. Any questions so far before just like diving into this here? Yes.
How can you say that all suffering is the same? Because there's so many different forms. A child born with leukemia, someone burning in a house. So, you know, there's just so many infinite forms of suffering.
Right. There are different manifestations of suffering, different forms of suffering. In Buddhism, we define suffering, the basic form of suffering, having and believing in an I, mine, in a self. And that's how basically the birth, that's our birth. We say we're born into suffering. That's what we're born with. Just the very fact of having a body. It's like, I am me, that body. That's kind of like the definition of suffering. Because then anything you encounter is you're encountering it. Like, I am seeing red, you know, it's me and red. And then whatever relationship you have to this color red would be either I like it or I don't like it. And that's kind of the links, the 12 links of dependency arising. This ignorance, there is an I. Out of this I, out of this sense of self, comes the formation of liking red or liking ice cream or all of these predispositions that we find ourselves with. Ultimately, if you start thinking about why do I like something and not the other? Why do I like go along with one person and not the other? What is it? It's just there's some kind of predisposition, there's some kind of tendency that we find ourselves with. And actually, there's no real explanation to it, you know. Why are we drawn to certain people and not others? Why are we drawn to certain activities and not others? There's actually no clear explanation. The only explanation that makes sense is, oh, there's some predisposition, something that's, you know, came us to us before we were really thinking about it. So that goes further, right? Because then, you know, it's one thing to have a predisposition, but it's another thing to keep encountering events and then keep making choices over and over. Maybe one point you're like pretty conscious and say, oh, you know, I kept preferring vanilla ice cream over chocolate ice cream all my life. But actually today is the day I'm going to try chocolate ice cream. And you're going to, you know, make a new decision and a new conscious choice about, you know, are you this person that identified with only liking vanilla ice cream and suddenly like, no, I'm going to open myself to new experiences. And we do that. I mean, this is part of what we're doing. And that's part of our, you know, where we feel we grow as a person, we grow emotionally and spiritually by exploring new ideas, new events, new, you know, and we don't if we lock down, if we kind of keep ourselves shut in certain, this is how it is and nowhere other way. So that's kind of like where we define ourselves and kind of limit ourselves to a certain strengthening of certain formations. And out of this interaction, out of this tendency, out of this way of our being, that's where suffering, that confrontation or that those choices, those not getting, being able to get out of this. The only way really getting out of this is to understand, well, who is this I on the first place that is encountering all these formations and dispositions. And so, you know, that can go on endlessly, and it is going on endlessly. But the turning point, and that's why we celebrate compassion, the turning point that where compassion is. Because compassion is defined in Buddhism particularly as a wish of wanting to be free of suffering. Compassion is the very seed, it's the very beginning for us to be able to wake up to our who we truly are, to our an experience of ourselves that's not disconnected from others, from life. Like there's no more choices because you're waking up to emptiness, which is undifferentiated. If anything is undifferentiated in this world, it's emptiness. And emptiness, again, is this freedom from constructs, freedom from a self, freedom from anything compounded. It's that which is like in and through everything. And some people talk about it as light. Some people talk of it as an absence, but ultimately it is a non-dual understanding. Like that. So and compassion and emptiness go together because compassion is like kind of like, you can say the dynamo that propels that understanding of emptiness, because freedom from suffering is kind of the The wish for us to be free of suffering is for us to see how we are all one, how we are all one emptiness. We all want one unity of undifferentiable emptiness, shunyata. So, question about that before I talk more about compassion. Yes.
Why do we want suffering to end? Mm-hmm.
I feel the sense of why we want suffering to end because we know it. It life can't be that way. There's like a sense of we know something. Like there's already a pre-knowing, and that's why actually the beauty is. I think at one point we're going to look back and see that we're not born in ignorance, but we're born in wisdom. The wisdom of knowing that we're not meant to, you know, be in the ditch and be in total pain. We just part of us know that there's an end to pain. There's an end to feeling separate or an end to, because we have experienced those moments of unity, of happiness, of peace, because we have experienced them, we know that those are way stronger. Like how easy, like a mother who has born child, it's often said they're like just so happy, even though it was this excruciating pain, right? But it's forgotten. Just like suffering can be easily forgotten because in the moments of joy, there's no memory of suffering anymore. And I think in this way, we intuitively truly know that there is an end to suffering. And yeah, and that's also very much coming to the point that compassion is actually, we don't need to take classes on compassion. We know compassion. Like there's nothing about compassion that we have to kind of learn. It's innate to us. For example, yesterday, Kokyu kindly gave a Zazen Kai and he gave talks. And you mentioned the awakening experience of Suzuki Roshi, some of you who were here. And I'm not going to go into the whole story, but it involved a hook that got into his cheek. And I remember like listening to the story and just like trying to figure out and visualize how that would have happened based on Kokyu's explanation. But then later on, I was in my room resting and and it just shivered my whole body, just like the hook in the cheek. It was just like the hole in blood. And it was just like, I don't need to learn that, right? It's just our body innately feels like you hear the thing of hook and blood and there's like something cringing there, right? So we don't need to learn that. It's happening innately. And it's strange because like I feel, for example, as hippies, you know, we know that the whole resistance to the Vietnam War was actually most widespread because the news was like plastered with horrible imagery. That was one of the situations of why there was such a resistance to it. And it's interesting that the news is still plastered with horrible imagery, but I think there's just some self-protection going on, you know, because we're vulnerable. We also sometimes need to protect ourselves from just an onslaught of horrible imagery, and you know, and that's more or less, particularly if you're working in a field where you're constantly confronted with suffering, there's some kind of way of training to numb our suffering. But it doesn't mean we need to learn suffering. It just needs to we need to feel safe. We need to feel relaxed in order to be able to have our innate capacity to be fully active. So in this way, it's of compassion, our innate sense of compassion is the beginning of the path. It's like the gem, the seed of the mind of awakening. It's like of wanting to be free of suffering. That's, you know, that's how a lot of us get here. You know, we have suffering and troubles in our lives and be like, I gotta sit down more, I gotta look at my mind. I wanna listen to some teachings that feel like I feel that really helped me with my suffering. So that's how a lot of us got here. And in the middle of our path, it's also compassion is the very thing that it's helping sustain our motivation, you know. So here it is, we're like looking at our mind and we are listening to teachings that are, you know, helping us to understand life more, understanding our mind more, helping us freeing ourselves from suffering. I mean, some of you who really have been sitting longer, have you encountered that, you know, your suffering has lessened? Yes, no. Yeah, some noddings. Yes. So that's
absolutely
there. How? Yeah. Yeah. So there's something we're looking back over the years of practicing and to be like, wow, I was in so much more trouble decades ago than now. And I feel like, yeah, that very much has to do with, you know, continuous practice and looking at the mind and learning to understand life more. So so in this way, what is it that sustains my practice? I feel definitely it is the continuous wish for my lessening of suffering, but also for others being so suffering. I feel like my skillfulness comes from wanting to help other beings, you know, and it's mostly trial and error, unfortunately. Sometimes you want to help people and then they're telling us that was not helpful and then we need to reconsider, but ultimately there is a way forward. And it also helps us to, having compassion is to encounter the onslaught of, in Buddhism, it's called the lack of gratitude, you know? So it's like, if you want to be helpful in this world, it's not necessary if you were grateful for that, you know, that you encounter beings that are like, yes, please help me. It's not like that. Most people are like, no, please get off my turf. You know, it's like, I want to do what I want and you shouldn't tell me what to do. So there's a certain sense of that generating compassion, not only for that suffering, but also for there's just a whole tendency of us beings of wanting to be who we are and wanting to make our own choices and not necessarily choices that are helpful to ourselves or others, that also deserve a lot of compassion, a lot of, you know, patience, a lot of ability to not give up. The greatest inspiring instruction here I heard once from one of my teachers, who said that the compassion of a bodhisattva is like that of a therapist who is with his alcohol addicted client and willing to just be with this person, like not able to let go of the substance, all the way to that multiple lifetime when that person finally is ready. So it's just this kind of like continuous, I understand you're not ready, I understand you're not ready, and I'm still not abandoning you. And you know, it's like this determination to not abandoning somebody in their pain. And but also, you know, taking the measure, you know, okay, you're not ready, and you know, I'm not going to enable you. There's a whole skillfulness we all know from our friends, dealing with our friends, but to also not abandon this person emotionally, at least on the emotional level of wishing them to be free of suffering. And so compassion, that's the middle of the path and the end of the path. At the end of the path, that's like harvesting the fruit of understanding our unity, harvesting the fruit of understanding emptiness. During that time, it is also the, you know, wish of wanting to be free of suffering that enables that closure, that enables our Buddhahood. As we know of the story of Shakyamuni, who was motivated to wanting to have the end of suffering, not only for himself, but for his family, right? He, like the story said, he really wanted also to return to his family and then to tell them about what he found. And I feel like that intermediate pain of him going away was necessary for him to be able to return. You know, so taking the measures, taking the full extent of his determination to wanting to reach awakening. And the different kinds of compassion before I go into the other, any questions about what I've said so far, anything you want to say from your own experience? Okay. Then I just want to share you the different kinds of compassion because they are found at the beginning of a treatise called the Madhyamika Avatara, where the author is commenting on a text on Nagarjuna, who was a well-known figure in Buddhist studies, as he is the one to take on the Prajnaparamita literature and commenting on it in such a way that it's very convincing to understand that emptiness is the one thing that's left, basically. So Nagarjuna is explaining emptiness or the Prajnaparamita in a way where he is using a method that if you would say, you know, there is arising of plants, he would look at that, what that arising is, you know, where is that arising really happening? And he's using logic, logical reasoning in the form of syllogisms the way they have been in India back then, that would really break it down, like break down our thinking and our ideas to such an extent that the only thing that's left is just this non-conceptual insight, like just like this deep, deep admiration for us being free of construct of ideas. And so this Madhyamika Avatara is also going into that. And in the beginning, he, because it's such a densely intellectual exercise to arrive at deconstructing any forms of thoughts or ideas, that, you know, one can get cold in that, you know, it's like a cold, like just strict, following strict rules. And, you know, and I think in many ways one could maybe say Zen is parallel to that. Like many of us knowing Zen, you know, there's these koan practices, and the koan practices too are all about deconstructing our ideas, you know. And one can then rightly say, well, where is the whole compassion that? It's just like this very aim-driven spiritual exercise container that we're doing here. Where is that compassion? And so before I go into what Chandrakirti in the Madhyamika Avatara is saying about it, I just want to parallel that actually with Lin Chi, who also was trying to explain compassion as being the main force for this deconstruction process, for this, you know, emptiness, trying to understand emptiness. So his story is that he was called in to his teacher for Dokusan because he kind of didn't go. He was at the monastery for 6 years. He never went there. He never went to Dokusan, and teacher was like, why don't you come, you know, see me? You gotta see me. And so Lin Chi went there, and he's like, what is Buddhism or something? And he said something, and Lin Chi responded to the question of the teacher. The teacher just hit him, you know, just like smacked him. And he's like, well, I didn't do anything wrong. I was correct. I'm doing my forms correct. I'm doing my answers correct. I'm doing everything correct. I'm the perfect Zen student. And here's my teacher hitting me. I don't get it. So he left. He left the monastery. Just didn't like the way he was treated, I guess. So he went to another teacher complaining. So you went there complaining. I was like, I went over there and I didn't do anything wrong. He hit me. It was horrible. And the teacher said, you are so kind to you. So kind to you. Well, what happened? Now we can see what happened. Lin-Chi was in a constructed world, like had it all figured out, had all the strategies laid out of how you can survive in Zen monasteries with all the rules and all everything, you know, managed to sit for hours, managed to answer correctly about questions of Buddhism. He figured it out. And somebody just like disturbs his, just it gives him a disturbance. You know, hitting is definitely a good disturbance because like it's the ego's, you know, if you want to know where your ego is, just find yourself wrong, you're accused. And you definitely know where yourself is. So yeah, so that was it. He aroused the sense of self in Lin-Chi and saw that he wasn't free of it. He wasn't free of that self, the very core of all the suffering. Lin-Chi wasn't free of. And when he was told that being hit was the kindest thing that was happening to him, he actually snapped out of his constructed little world and was free. And so in many ways, this story or this experience has been in Zen and the reference point for compassion. You know, that's a reference point, the grandmotherly mind, you know, the kind mind, grandmotherly mind. That's one of the big reference points of compassion. But in India, they're like longer stories than that. So in India, the story that's in this text that I mentioned, there are three kinds of compassion. The compassion to sentient beings, the compassion to transient or impermanent beings, and no referential compassion. So compassion to beings, I think that we talked about that. That's all of us who are clinging to I and mine, you know, my eyes, you know, my leg hurts. So that kind of mind that has this contraction around an identity and having possession, being a possession of a body, having a self. And again, there is this whole being born out of ignorance, but also craving and grasping, you know. So it's one thing to like think you have a self. It's another to you know, like my leg hurts and I'm craving and I'm for it or the grasping for it to not hurt. So that kind of this is like one of our mind's defilements. And the other one is to have the formation of how we deal with that, you know, just like don't sit at all, or if we sit, you know, we want to move, or whatever is our disposition of how we want to respond to pain. So that's the kind of being, you know. So one kind of compassion is compassion towards this being, who we are, this sense of self that we have, that we act on. But through listening to wisdom and listening to the teaching of emptiness, that can lessen. And the way it lessens is that we really, really, really take the teaching on impermanence to heart. That's like the first major step for us to mature on our path. In fact, one can say that a person who reflects on impermanence, reflects on how things change, that everything changes, that person is a practitioner. So if you're wondering, you know, if you're practicing or not, it's like, how often do you think about the fact that you're going to die? How often do you think about the fact that your friends and family is going to die? How often do you think about the fact that, you know, the day is going to go fast and it's one day less in your life? And so as much as people like maybe say, oh, that's like so depressing to think about that, it has a very motivating quality to it. And that quality is like, well, there's nothing left to practice but wanting to end suffering. That's our little seed, you know, of wanting to end suffering, that's being nurtured in this compassion reflection about our impermanence. So that's why that's the second form of compassion, thinking about impermanence and knowing ourselves as impermanent beings. So if you know somebody who is who you really dearly love, somebody who you really care about, think about how they might die one day, someday, you don't know when. If you know somebody who is annoying you and you feel that this person totally blocks you in your activities, think about this person can suddenly be gone. That's, you know, things change, things can change, and things do change. So that's the second form of compassion, is seeing ourselves and seeing others in this transient way. And that alone, I mean, like, how much love do we find on the deathbed of a beloved? There's just so just unhindered, not hold back love that's coming out there, because we know it's ending. That form of ending is just like helping us to really let our own heart shine. And then the last one is a compassion out of, with no reference point. So meaning it's a compassion that knows, it just knows our true nature so well. It knows non-duality so well. It has tasted it. You know, you have tasted it. Your mind has known what it is like to be at peace. That this third kind of compassion is just this deep yearning wanting to be there. It's just, you know, Rumi talks about it in his poetry about the beloved, you know, it's just this kind of yearning for love, that yearning for wanting to be free of all that constrains you or your loved ones. And that kind of that's like a form of compassion. It's this kind of wanting to be there, wanting to be at the end of the road. Now I want to definitely opening up to everything you have to say. Did you hear any questions or anything? I was just talking about compassion, the role of compassion, how it is so central to our path, that there is really no other way for us to progress on the path besides having compassion, wisdom, be joined together, having them nurture each other and foster each other. That's just kind of the being in our that our true being, which is compassion, and the teaching of emptiness, which we also truly are, that just merging each other and working each other, and our giving ourselves to this process is helping us. So any questions or any statements or any experiences around that come to your mind? Yes, Jackie.
Am I unmuted? No. Can you hear me? Okay. I get very confused about choice and about having no preferences. And yet, you know, and having a limited lifetime. And you know, if you have no preferences, do you just drift through life from one thing to the next, doing whatever seems right in that moment? I mean, I just don't get it, because I, you know, there's certain things I'm very attached to. Like, I would like to write something that is good and makes a difference. I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I would like to explore that, but I'm attached to the writing part, right? It's like, I can't let that part go. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you're saying, no, let it all go. Just go with the moment. And I don't get that, because that feels really horrible to me. And maybe I just have to let go of my attachment to all of that. So can you help?
I'm not sure I can help, but I definitely can relate right now very well, because I'm in a similar place about my writing. That I have to do, and what I hear you say about your writing is all of this wish of wanting, you know, this goodness that you feel, but the goodness that you know, you want it to be out there, Is that kind of what I heard you say?
Well, yeah, I want something that's worthwhile other people reading that will delight or get be of some benefit or, you know, for others.
Right. Yeah, and what I hear you say and what I'm seeing, and let me you chime in how that resonates, is the goodness that I talked about is our true nature. It's just there, and you know it. You know it. Now, writing is discriminative mind. It's mm-hmm. like making distinctions, you know. How do you put the sentence, you know? How does it relate to each other, you know? And the discriminate night, we definitely are very sharp. And in our culture, we learned how to discriminate, just like, you know, and we're good at it. And it's a good tool, very sharp. It's like a sharp razor blade. And if you have a sharp razor blade, we have to be very careful of how we handle it, you know? So in the form of writing, I heard, and I'm really still learning myself, that those who are writers and who have made it their central focus, they really just do it every day, like every day, just writing. And I feel like what I hear from that is trying to create a balance, because if you have your nature of mind that wants to come forward and be in the world, you love, you're compassionate, you want to be in the world, and then you have the discriminative mind, which is sharp razor blade. If the mind is too sharp, your goodness that comes out is just like already like cut by the root. It's like a little plant that's just already like cut right there. It's because it doesn't have a chance. There's just too much discriminative mind going on. You know, it's just like immediately like, no, wait a minute, how would that fit into anything? You know, but it's just coming out. So it's kind of like too early sometimes to see, you know. So to just write out, have like a time, like 10 minutes of just writing, it lets that, it gives that place, give it some space, you know, without discrimination, like give it some time to really engage in non-discriminating activity, just see what's there, just to see what's actually there. And then let that inform you, you know, let that be like a jumping place or a starting place to make your exploration, and then learn through that slowly how to balance that innate wish, that goodness, that love that wants to come forward with that discriminative mind, you know. Because I think you're right, in your intuition, it's not just like whatever, you know. We do need some differentiation. The differentiation comes through you know, circumstance, experience, but you immediately saying that's preferences, and I'm not sure. You know, one can say to the way we form sentences, for example, is a certain preference we have. But I feel like if I were to discriminate my expression just at the get-go, I wouldn't even say anything, you know, because it's just like, it's just too much discrimination. It's just in the way. So sometimes you have to just relax with the way we, you know, choose words and the way we choose our foods and, you know, certain things. There's a range of our being that we just learn how to be, how to just accept, you know, because the causes of it are too far down the road, so to speak. And we don't need to worry about it, because, like, you know, it may be a good thing. I mean, we don't know. It's just there's a certain relaxation that maybe helps form. Mm-hmm.
Well, I do a lot of that, actually. my thing is settling on a project. Okay. And a project can be a multi-year project.
Yes. Right? Yes.
And so that's where I go, I've only got maybe 20 years of good brain left.
Right. So you kind of worried of how to make a commitment, like of making a commitment to a certain project?
Yeah, in case it's the wrong one. or it's a dead end, or, and I'm sure this is generalizable to other kind of big projects. So there's that, you know.
Well, do you have a friend that you that knows you very well that you can bounce things off and who you trust?
Yeah, I'm in a couple of writers groups. Mm-hmm. So that's helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody who knows you and what you personally love, who can like help you find, you know, your heart's desire. Like, and sometimes you know, actually, like, again, like, to not take it so serious. For example, I'm sometimes in supermarket, I'm in front of all the choices of things. Sometimes I just turn to the person next to me and say, well, which soup do you like? And then I'm like, well, then I try it out, because it's just, what am I gonna do? You know, I mean,
yeah.
The beauty of that and the trust I have with that, even when I make it with more important things, you know, then of course turn to somebody I really respect, you know, not just some random person. But I think the trust with that is that we are all one, you know. So the response you're getting is coming from yourself in some way or another, particularly if that's a person that who you trust. So that person, it is you, ultimately, who is saying, giving you the response, because it's coming in relation to you and it's coming in trust to you. If it's somebody you know really loves you and cares about you, you can know that what the person is going to tell you and the decision that person is going to help you guide into will be into what you will be in relation to your not suffering, you know, to you coming to the best of yourself. So I guess love really has a lot to do with helping each other find happiness.
That's actually very helpful. Thank you
for wanting to bring yourself forward. That's really beautiful.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be, the Zen way would be just do whatever you do and don't worry about the outcomes. As soon as you worry about the outcome, you destined it, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, and I understand the thing of not having enough time, you know, then I think that's when like a lot of thoughts can come in of, oh, is that the best way to spend my time? And it's interesting because I find myself worried about that too. And then I just want to try to avoid the question altogether, you know, and that's not helping either. So yeah, sometimes it's kind of a brave act to like make a choice. A choice is actually a very daring thing to do. Take a choice to deal with our precious short life. Yeah. Any question? Yes, Peter. Oops, you're muted.
Thank you, Shoho, for being there and all you've done for Jikoji this past summer and prior to that, and for the subject of compassion. It was something I think I heard very little of in my initial decades of Zen practice. And I think it wasn't until Angie began to speak and maybe set the way for others like Paula and Carolyn and yourself that we started hearing about love and compassion in the Zendo. And it makes it feel more complete than the somewhat male-oriented teachers that at least you know, sort of dominated the our particular lineage in, you know, when I encountered it in, you know, 46 years ago. So I'm very grateful for that, and I'm sure that the part of it, of course, was male teachers like Coben that found the compassion within themselves to let the female voice be spoken and be heard, because it certainly does bring more unity to the teaching when the compassion is there alongside with the wisdom. So thank you for this subject, and mostly thank you and all those female voices with you that help us to that unity. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, without, I mean, I am making a sweeping statement here, and that is that, I guess, a yang tendency or the masculine tendency can very much be directed towards building structure, you know, creating structure. And so I think it's maybe also the time of Buddhism in the West where we finally have temples and we have things established. So in those years, like 40 years when you were 50 years that you were practicing, that was all about, you're a pioneer, right? It's all about getting Buddhism in here into this country and trying to share it with people and trying to get the structure right of how to do sesshin and how to do things and priorities about that and decisions around that, and that this dust is now suddenly settling, because look at it, we're sitting in a beautiful sendo. It's you know, we came off those tatami mats, we got a nice floor, we like there are a lot of decisions that were made, and now maybe the you know, now the fire in the stove can be nurtured, the feminine energy of nurturing and so forth has definitely found its way and its voice now. That's beautiful. So it just shows again of how beautiful male and female energy can go work together in that way. Yeah.
Sorry, the question. Huh? Isn't compassion inherent in the vows? When we chant, illusions are inexhaustible, I doubt it. Dharma is inexhaustible, you know, all that compassion inherent in that.
Yeah, definitely the Bodhisattva precept, which is the fascinating part of Buddhism in Japan that was first, you know, started off as a Vinaya precepts that were like very much body oriented and cutting off desire, and then Seicho in the 10th century, 8th, was like just let's put that aside, let's just focus on Bodhisattva precepts, because you know, I feel like maybe Japan's very community oriented, and it's just like very much a part of that focus in that country to have the Bodhisattva precepts be part of the lineage. And in this way, yeah, compassion, Bodhisattva precepts, it takes the precepts, is very much a compassionate act. And I encourage you to reflect upon it if you want to take on the precepts. And you can talk with your Zen teacher about it, because it's a powerful step to do. I feel like when I took the precepts first with Vanya and Kohun, there was a sense of really release of some karmic formation, some karmic baggage that was released because some new formation was committed to in front of the community and in front of my teacher. And so I very much encourage you all to consider that. So I heard the bell here, and there's no last minute things. It would be time for lunch.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.